we'll get started. slowly, probably a couple more people may wander in, but thank you again all for coming back, third week. And if you have the handout, this side, which I'll be using mainly for most of the lecture, I've changed the schedule at the very bottom of the page. I adjusted the order of lectures a little bit for weeks 4 and 5 because I think it makes more sense to turn them around. So next week, when we turn into the specifically case studies from the Hindu tradition and then the question of how those reflect back to the Christian tradition theologically, I thought it made more sense to do Revelation first and issues of holy text, Revelation, how one lives by the text in the Hindu tradition first, and then do the arguments about true religion and true religions from the Hindu perspective in week 5. And then we'll continue at least week 6 with Martin Guarneri's presentation, and week 7 on incarnation from a Hindu perspective, or embodiment, or avatara. And then we can talk in a couple of weeks about week 8, whether there should be a week 8, or whether we'll stop before we get that far. Just to recall, since I'm very aware from week to week that our time is very short, and that I'm throwing many things at you that perhaps we may have further questions about, just a comment about last week before moving into this week's material. I was really exemplifying by the example of the Jesuit Brahmin encounter in South India the fact that history is important, and that we're never at the beginning or in a kind of totally pure or uncommitted point of relationship between our own religious tradition and somebody else's religious tradition. But I think in every religious tradition, and certainly the Christian, there's a set of encounters and interconnections that go back for a very long time. And the point of looking at the Jesuits in South India, which happened to be an example I knew something about, was to see how that history makes a difference. The history itself is important. I think we're aware that we'll never know enough of the history, so we always kind of have to be asking ourselves, am I using a certain concept or a certain idea or a certain attitude uncritically, without realizing that it has a history, and at least to have that in mind, even if we can't do all the history. But then secondly, I think the example that I was using of the Jesuits and Brahmins was showing in a way how the interaction is a creative process, that Jesuits like Robert de Noboli in particular, in South India, not simply discovering India in some neutral sense, but finding the people that they could, that Jesuits could talk to, and kind of idealizing the Brahmin in a certain way so that the Brahmin could be somebody who could become a Christian, and the Brahmin is an ideal that Jesuits themselves could share without having to dabble in what in those days might have been called superstition or idolatry. So kind of reconstructing the Brahmin as a cultural figure with very little essential religious character to being a Brahmin. That's still a controversial issue. There's still studies talked about the nature of caste in India, religious class, and what the kind of status is of being a Brahmin. But certainly the Jesuits were reconstructing it in a way that separated culture and religion and argued that caste is basically a cultural and not a religious context. The two further points I'll make on that, and then just see if you have any carryover questions from that discussion last week. One is that this conversation that the Jesuits were part of by studying the Brahmins in South India is eventually one that they lost control of. By the end of the 18th century, I mentioned the crossover from the work of the Jesuit Cordu, kind of a full-blown study of the caste system, almost for its own sake anthropologically. This is what caste is all about. That was taken over by Abbé Dubois in his book on Indian religion, and that became a real basic book for simply the study of India in general, whether or not one had an interest in religious issues or in caste issues or in the kind of encounter of cultures on a religious basis. And I think it partially was simply the fact of history, how things worked, but also was if you make a division between the cultural material and the religious material, you may not be able to control the distinction you make. And so you end up in the 19th century with kind of the Orientalist study of India, which becomes kind of an objective study in which the religious issues and issues of religious practice are left out. And in a sense, a lot of the history of the recent 15, 20, 25 years has been trying to bring religious practice back into the conversation after it had been taken out and kind of separated off. One other, and two other points actually. One was, this, I don't mean to say that because I'm a Jesuit and I was talking about Jesuits in India, one can simply have a straight line, single line from Francis Xavier to Robert de Nobili to now, because we're all part of multiple histories. And there's no way to sort out and say, well, if this hadn't happened or if so-and-so hadn't written that book, then we wouldn't be thinking such and such. But all these things are kind of intertwined with other histories and other issues in Europe, in the Americas, in India over time. And then finally, as I regretted last week, and I just expressed the same regret again, almost everything I said was from the Christian side. Both the Jesuit view of the Brahmins and then the Jesuit reports on what the Brahmins thought in return. To do a really full and adequate study, and this is certainly possible in more modern times, you'd want to hear the other voice too. And so this is what we think about you, well, what do you think about us, to try to have kind of a multiple level conversation. All of this is just one example that I was opening up, and I think the point would be that you can do these multiple examples with Catholic, with Orthodox, with Protestant histories of encounter. You can do the early church, you can do the modern church, you can do different parts of the world. And I think many of them would point to similar issues as I was raising last week. So very briefly, before I move into today's material, was there any question or thought anyone would like to raise that we didn't have time for last week?
John? Maybe you're going to bring it up today, but there was the little blurb you had about the Vatican II's sort of summary of what their understanding of different religions. And you would agree even that that was not quite as accurate. Have they updated that, or is there...
Okay, that will come in today. So that's actually a big point today. So I'll come to that in a few minutes. If I don't, you can ask again. Okay, then today's topic, as I simply put there at the top of today's handout, light on some contemporary Roman Catholic resources, is really an effort to raise another kind of question without pretending to go into it in any great depth. If covering the entire missionary history of the church was a big task for last week, covering the theological Christian consideration of other religious traditions today is also impossible. And I'm not pretending to be comprehensive. As I mentioned right at the start, I'm dealing mainly with Roman Catholic resources, and I tend to deal with Jesuit Roman Catholic resources, those being things I know. And the point is not, again, that these are the most important things. Some of them are very important, but rather it's an example of a way of thinking. And the issue, I think, basic issue that I'll make a point of over the next 45 minutes, and I'd like to give Martin a few minutes at the end because he has a few points on the same issue, is that a major turning point with Vatican II, the document Nostrae Aetate in 1965, was not the solution of the problem of world religions or kind of the final rendering of the meaning of the world religions, but rather a shift toward a kind of two-way conversation in which the identity and the complexity of the other religious traditions became a living factor for the church. And I think it's a subtle attitude that wasn't necessarily caused by Vatican II, but the document Nostra Aetate kind of opened the way for this to take place. And it sets up the possibility, I think, for what I'll be doing in the weeks to come, where instead of working out a Christian theology of religion entirely from the Christian perspective, the emphasis that has developed in the past 35, 40 years since Vatican II has really been to see that one cannot have a one-way dialogue. A monologue on religious identity is not going to work. One has to be able to move back and forth and introduce complexities into the discussion. I give you there, in a few examples, theological positioning before Vatican II. And again, this is just a few points. Part of the point is that the encounter with other religious traditions, as I said last week, was not invented in the 20th century. Right back to the New Testament, to the earliest days of the church, as reflected in texts like the Acts of the Apostles, there is certainly the working out of Christian identity in conversation with the other. I suspect to some extent there is going to be in each generation a kind of interaction between religious traditions, the Christian and other traditions in this case, that depends on the cultural context. So when the Christian community was extremely small, barely existent as a reality, in the very large Roman Empire and the very dominant Greco-Roman world, that conversation took on a certain form and shape of a minority in a very large civilization. So too, since many of the early Christian writers, writing in classical Greek and then later in Latin, were themselves highly educated representatives of society and well-versed in the religious literature of the society, they're having kind of an internal dialogue as well as external. They weren't discovering Greek literature from outside the Greek world, but rather, in a way, we're kind of having an internal conversation with themselves about how do we think about being part of this Greco-Roman heritage, our literature, our culture, our civilization, while also claiming that we are Christian. So what does this Greek heritage have to do with the new kind of discipleship of Christ that we have discovered in our experience of becoming Christian? I mentioned there, number two, the encountering the Greek and other European cultures. And obviously, this too can be documented at length. But it seemed to be that in the early centuries, there was kind of the formative development of Christian identity in terms of the growth of Christianity in the Roman Empire, the encounter, first of all, with the Greco-Roman world, but then with the other cultures of Europe and North Africa and the Mideast, in a way in which there was kind of, you might say, a simultaneous reflection on the roots and doctrines of the Christian tradition, while at the same time having the encounters with the other. And these things were all kind of happening in different conversations that were overlapping all the time. Whereas you can argue that when you get to medieval Europe, let's say, many of the kind of the basic creeds of Christianity and the doctrines of the Christian church had already taken a certain shape and form, which would be nuanced and developed over history. But then new encounters would take place in terms of a church that already had its own identity. Whereas in the earliest church, there was a great period of flux in which both self-identity and encounter with the other were taking place at the same time. One might argue on that basis, for instance, therefore, that now, as the church, the Christian churches are becoming global institutions, and as in a modern and postmodern world, there are all kinds of changes in traditional Christian cultures, the church rethinking its identity in different parts of the world, and a whole new wave of encounter with other religious traditions, that there's another kind of simultaneous transformation taking place. So we no longer have kind of an entirely settled understanding of what it means to be Christian or Catholic, and then reaching out to other religious traditions, but that these things are coming at the same time. Christians are meeting Hindus and Buddhists and Muslims and Jews and people of other faiths, and talking about the Trinity, and talking about Christological issues at the same time. I've already talked about number four, and to some extent number three last week, by the fact that even when you have the development of Christian doctrine in a fairly definitive fashion, and the councils defining fairly strong positions about the meaning of Christ, the meaning of God, the Trinitarian relationships, and so on, there was also kind of the more popular ways of finding ways of being Christian in different culture. And I think one always has to keep in mind, as you do in the post-Vatican II church, that there's kind of the official teaching of the church and the official development of church positions, while a lot of other things are going on locally in the church. All kinds of borrowing, all kinds of accommodation, all kinds of practices and pieties that become part of Christian life from, you might say, from down below, just as you have kind of the doctrinal structures kind of descending from above. And these things are actually mixed together. So just as now, so too in the early church, one would not imagine that simply things were decided at councils and then everybody followed along, but that the church and being Christian was kind of being reinvented in different contexts and working its way up. And for me, of course, that's a major theme in these lectures, that the experience and the learning of people who call themselves Christian in the modern world has an effect ultimately on church doctrine and theology. And it's not simply that the theological positions shape the encounters, but the encounters also shape the ways of thinking about the religions. Number five, four I've talked about, number five, when you certainly get to the modern world, and again, I'm not a historian of church history either, but when you get to the, let's say, 16th century on in terms of Catholic and then Protestant identity, there are ways in which the presence of the church toward people of non-Christian religious traditions is affected by how Christians are acting toward one another. And in a divided and somewhat hostile environment in Europe, where there's a great deal of kind of positioning and self-defense and critique of the other, there's a kind of very definitive nature to Christian doctrine and definitive nature to the presentation of the church, and a very strong suspicion of syncretism or living or acting in ways that are not in conformity with church doctrine that have to do with tensions in Europe. Many of those same kind of attitudes of extreme kind of concern about orthodoxy and orthopraxis carry over to other parts of the world. And so you can see some of the debates, let's say, with Catholic and Protestant missionaries in India about image worship or about the religious practices of the culture and whether these could be Christianized. Part of it is Roman Catholics talking to Hindus, Protestants talking to Hindus, but also the Catholics talking to the Hindus while looking at the Protestants, and the Protestants talking to Hindus while looking at the Catholics, and accusing. So, you know, you're a Hindu, you're almost as bad as the Roman Catholics, and things like that will come to the fore. So these other things need to be worked out. When you get to the, let's say, post-World War II period, and the opening up, and certainly with Vatican II, of a kind of a new era in Catholic-Protestant relationship, and the ending of kind of a very strongly polemical culture, in which there are all kinds of new ways of Catholic, Anglican, Catholic, Lutheran, and other kinds of dialogue taking place, even though these are not logically connected to Catholic-Hindu dialogue or Catholic-Jewish dialogue, nonetheless, there is a sense of opening possibilities inside Christianity that are also possibilities outside of Christianity. And so these matter as well. Number seven, I won't go through all of these in detail. Number seven is a famous instance of where the church was in the 19th century, the so-called Syllabus of Errors of Pope Pius IX. Put forward a fairly definitive set of the issues and problems facing the church and the kinds of positions that could not be taken up by Roman Catholics. And I'll just read you a couple of them as a way of example. Not really to criticize them, because to criticize them fairly, I think we'd have to go back and read in context and kind of figure out what was going on in 1864 or so, but rather to kind of emphasize where things were and how dramatically they changed 100 years later. These are a list of errors that Pius IX lists. Everyone is free to embrace and profess the religion which, by the light of reason, one judges to be true. So everyone is free to embrace and profess the religion which, by the light of reason, one judges to be true. That's an error. Human beings can find the way of eternal salvation and attain eternal salvation by the practice of any religion whatsoever. That's another error. We should at least have good hope for the eternal salvation of all those who are in no way in the true Church of Christ. So we can hope for the salvation of those outside the church. That's another error. And then the fourth example, the church has no power to define dogmatically that the religion of the Catholic Church is the only true religion. Another error, namely that the church does have the power to define dogmatically that the religion of the Catholic Church is the only true religion. So this was not a great period of openness, and one does not find, at least I have not found, maybe historians might find, in the 19th century, interesting kind of dialogues among religions and interesting ways in which Catholics are thinking about Hinduism or Buddhism or Islam and so on. And part of it, again, I think Pius IX was actually probably not talking about Hindus or talking about Buddhists, but he's talking about kind of an attitude of relativism inside the Catholic Church or inside Christian Europe, and therefore kind of shut certain doors before they had even been discovered or opened. Changes come in 8 and 9, 10 and 11, really, all of these, to highlight, again, without any definite historical order, that already before the World Council, the Vatican Council in 1962 to 1965, in which the document Nostra Aetate was put forward, the church was already in change. Who knows why? I mean, changes in the cultural context of Europe, a new sense of ecumenism, the after effect of World War II, the growth of American, North American societies. All kinds of things came to the fore that kind of began to change the relationship of how Catholics thought about themselves and thought about their others. a famous case, for instance, this 1949 letter regarding Father Leonard Feeney, who was a Jesuit in Boston, a chaplain at Harvard University for some time, took the ancient and traditional teaching of the church that there is no salvation outside the church, and took it apparently in a fairly literal sense, that if there is no salvation outside the church, that meant that those outside the church are not saved. And that one can know with a certain certainty that not only Hindus and Buddhists and Jews, but also Protestants will not be saved. And for this position, he was eventually condemned, both by the Cardinal Archbishop of Boston, Cardinal Cushing, and also excommunicated, actually by Cardinal Cushing he was excommunicated, and I think that was backed up by the Vatican. That whatever the church meant to say about salvation inside and outside the church, and what it means to somehow be inside God's work in Christ, it did not mean that one could know with certainty that all people outside the church were damned. And so even today you may hear people saying, well, Catholics believe that people who aren't in the church are damned. That's a view that was officially condemned by the church even before Vatican II. That somehow there has to be a way of, as the syllabus errors tried to prevent, of hoping for the salvation of those outside. And this was kind of a new perspective. People as long ago in number 10 as Brahmabandhu Padhyay, who became a Brahmin Hindu in Calcutta at the end of the 19th century. De Lubac was a Jesuit scholar studying Buddhism. Raimondo Panikkar, writing in India, this famous book, The Unknown Christ of Hinduism. Karl Rahner, at the time of the council. All kinds of views were coming forward in the 10, 15, 20 years before the council, with lineages back another 100 years, of rethinking how Christ relates to the larger world. While even today, if you read the church documents, the very recent ones, some kind of a sense of a strong commitment to Christ as the way, or Christ as the Savior, or the mystery of God as revealed in Christ, an increasing desire even before the council of finding ways of talking about how Christ works outside the church, or how Christ works even among people who do not know who Christ is. I give you a quote on the other side, which I'll come back to in a few minutes. Quote number 3 is a famous quote from Karl Rahner, probably the most influential Catholic theologian of the 20th century, who wrote voluminously on the church and all kinds of related issues, positing in this quote and in the articles that are related to it that there are several ways of encountering Christ, and the ideal way is to be an explicit encounter, full active acknowledgement of who Christ is, kind of following faithfully after Christ within the Christian community and so on, but that just the fact of being human and the fact of being in a world that is created by God means that one is already implicitly in some kind of a relationship to Christ even before you know it. And so kind of making, without any particular knowledge, Rahner was not a scholar of Hinduism or Buddhism or other religious traditions, but kind of thinking about how Christ is present in the world, wanting to say that even the people who have never heard of Christ or heard of Christ and rejected Christ for whatever reason are somehow to be in contact with Christ already according to his faith. So he'll say this, there is and there has to be an anonymous and yet real relationship between the individual person and the concrete history of salvation, including Jesus Christ, even in someone who has not yet had the whole concrete, historical, explicit, and reflective experience in word and sacrament of this reality of salvation history. So that this anonymous, meaning unnamed, kind of not called Christian, operative, present in people's lives, but perhaps without them knowing it, that somehow Christ must be out there working in the world. I'll come back to this when I mention post-Vatican II things, because this becomes a more prominent issue that's explored in ways that really go beyond what Rahner said. Such a person, the person who's sort of out there outside the church, is no longer a person to be thought of as damned or lost, but such a person has this real and existential relationship merely implicit in obedience to his orientation and grace toward the God of absolute historical presence and self-communication. So kind of what does it mean to be human and open to transcendent reality? Or facing death and believing in some kind of a hope that goes beyond death, he would say that all human beings have that experience, and to have that experience is really to be encountering God in Christ. Now, of course, this is a totally Christian view of things, and you might say, well, thank you very much, but I didn't have that experience. I'm not a Christian. But I think we'll see in several weeks when I talk about Hindu perspectives on other religions, there are ways in which kind of traditions that claim kind of a universal view of the world have a view that even those who don't realize our God have some relationship to our God. But the main thing I think for the moment, in quoting Rahner, which is a difficult text like most of Rahner, is that there are ways of seeking outside and looking for kind of resources by which to find Christ in other religions. And when you get to Vatican II, which is the main thing then, turning to that the major 3 points or 4 points I have on the middle of the page, the other side, the main side, one is already in a climate where the council was kind of a, for Roman Catholics, it was such a decisive turning point, and it opened up so many possibilities in the life of the church regarding things as simple as, not as simple, but profound and transformatively simple, the Mass going from Latin into the vernacular languages, changing attitudes toward priests and nuns, changing attitudes toward the role of lay people in the church. All kinds of things happened between 1962 and 65 when all the bishops in the world got together. One of the items that was on the agenda of the council that took a while to work its way through the council, and there was even some doubt toward the end whether it would actually make it in as a true document of the council, is this one called Nostra Aetate, In Our Age or In Our Time. And it was basically out of the concern about World War II and the Holocaust and the fact that the Jewish people are almost exterminated. And kind of asking, well, what about something as awful as this, truly awful as the Holocaust, taking place in Europe that was supposed to be a Christian culture? And all the bad relationships, you know, both before, the history of anti-Semitism among Christians, the ways in which the church itself, the Vatican itself, was somehow involved in bias against people of Jewish background or heritage, forced conversions, expulsions, ghettos, all kinds of things that had a very sad history, made appallingly clear and terrible in the Holocaust, which of course had all kinds of other Nazi connections which weren't Christian and so on. But the feeling at the council, if we're going to talk about updating the church, we have to change our relationship to the Jewish people. We can't continue with this attitude that they're the Christ killers. And there has to be a new way of talking about Jewish-Christian relations. As the council developed, there were also concerns from bishops in places like India or East Asia or Africa. Well, if you're going to talk about the Jewish-Christian relationship, then you have to talk about Islam, and you have to talk about Hinduism and Buddhism, because we are also in cultural context where it's not really viable to go forward anymore simply saying, we have the right religion, you have the wrong religion, you should switch from your religion to our religion. There have to be other ways of talking about this relationship, and it would be extremely helpful to have some teaching from the Vatican, from the Vatican Council, changing the attitude of religions toward one another and kind of announcing a new Catholic attitude. So what began with the Council with a fairly definite idea of something on the Jewish-Christian relationship, perhaps not even a separate document, but part of another document, eventually became a small document, which I can make you copies, or you can, as I mentioned last week, you can download it. Just really a two-page document, it's very short, on the Christian relation, the Catholic relationship with people of other religious traditions. And it opened the door to a wider conversation. Half the document, as I mentioned, I think last week or the week before, half of it really is about Jewish-Christian relationships and opening up a way of talking about our common heritage, the importance of not thinking of a radical break between Jewish and Christian, but that to be Christian is to be in contact with the Jewish reality and Jewish tradition. The kind of thing that you could say, well, all right, Jewish-Christian is one thing and has really no relationship to Christian Hindu or Christian Buddhist, but nonetheless, it seemed to signal a change of attitude that once one begins to see that there are complementary interactions between Jewish and Christian, then there was a paragraph added on Islam. And the way that one has to rethink that with Muslim people, we share a heritage of Abraham, of Moses, of the prophets. Both Christians and Muslims have great esteem for Mary and Jesus, even though in different ways. And a common sense that we can no longer say, all right, we're here, you're there, and again, you should switch religions and join ours. But the Jewish and Muslim relations became opened up, and there were efforts to kind of rethink how we relate. And then as I gave you, I think already a quote and this is referring to Jonathan's question too, something to be said about the religions of Asia as well. There are three categories in the document. One seems to be about, I should say four categories. One category seems to be all human beings are basically religious. It talks about the unsolved riddles of the human condition, and that basically to be human is to be open to mystery, to want to understand what happens after death and so on, and that you don't have to be Christian or European or whatever to do this, but everybody sort of has an openness to the transcendent. This may echoing the kind of thing Rahner was saying, and that's part of his influence on the council, I think. So all human beings are religious, and therefore there's nobody in the world who's simply the enemy of the faith, or a person who's totally cut off from the Christian tradition, because everybody's sort of open to the same mysteries. It talks briefly about primitive religions, and it seems to mean people who have kind of inarticulate oral traditions that don't get written down, and they seem to be, you know, they live in the jungle and so on. It doesn't quite say that, but it seems to mean like tribal religions and aboriginal groups and so on, about whom one has to say that they also have some sense of God, although they haven't put it into doctrinal form. Very much like the Jesuit tradition I mentioned last week, the church tended to respect those traditions that have the great literature, the great books, and put in a separate category those who seem to have inarticulate oral traditions. And again, that's something I think we'd say differently today, because we appreciate the sophistication of oral cultures. And then the Asian religions, Hinduism and Buddhism, as you have on the other side of the page, the little quotation about Hinduism. Religions, however, that are bound up with a more advanced culture. So again, this religion-culture divide that Denobili was pointing to, the cultures and religions are somehow bound together, but they're not the same thing, have struggled to answer the same questions by more refined concepts and a more developed language. Thus, in Hinduism, men contemplate the divine mystery and express it through an inexhaustible abundance of myths and through searching philosophical inquiry. I think they had experts in Rome, probably Jesuits and others teaching at the Gregorian and different universities in Rome. You know, give us a few paragraphs about Hinduism. Give us something to say about Islam and so on. And kind of textbook knowledge that was put into a very brief form because they had a short document. The Hindus seek freedom from the anguish of our human condition, either through ascetical practices or profound meditation or a flight to God with love and trust. So some kind of classical themes you might find in the Upanishads or the Bhagavad Gita and other texts. So this isn't great. I mean, this is not profound insights into the Hindu tradition. But nonetheless, I think it's incredibly remarkable that an official document of the kind of highest authority of the Roman Catholic Church is struggling very much to say we can esteem what is going on in this religious tradition. Again, if you're a Hindu, you might say, well, thanks a lot. I mean, there's a lot more to be said. But I think looking at it from within a tradition, at the other tradition, struggling to find a way to talk positively about the other rather than condemning the other as false or superstitious or idolatrous and so on. And I think what was going on with Vatican II, with phrases and statements like that, is opening up a whole attitude that if the other somehow shares a lot with you, and if religiously we're sisters and brothers, and if we all have kind of the basic human religious questions, then we can't really live as if we're entirely separate from one another. We don't have to live as if we're enemies. And this began to open up relationships between the two, that in the 35 plus years since the 35 plus years since the end of the council, have vastly complicated as the knowledge of traditions begins to move back and forth. The only other thing I'll quote from Nostra Aetate is the famous statement that's always quoted: the Catholic Church rejects nothing that is true and holy in these religions. She regards with sincere reverence those ways of life and conduct, those precepts and teachings, which though differing in many aspects from the ones she holds and set forth, nonetheless often reflect a ray of the truth that enlightens all men. Women, we would also say today. Rejecting nothing that is holy and true in these traditions, honoring their conduct, their ways of life, their precepts, their teachings, is again said very generically, and part of the great tension, I think part of why I'm giving these lectures, is about filling that in. Well, what is it we're talking about? What is it that you can learn from another tradition that is genuinely other than your own, and yet you can still respect it and allow it to have an effect on you? Vatican II didn't solve that problem, but it opened the door toward that kind of reflection, also with a very clear sense of hierarchy. We have the light. The light of God has been given to us. The light who is Christ has come into the world. Other traditions have rays of the light. So the light is shining by God's grace, not by human achievement. God's grace is shining in the church and in the Christian tradition and in the Catholic tradition. And other traditions have rays of light. Nonetheless, they're rays of light. I mean, they're not rays of darkness. I mean, there's something going on positive that the council is trying to point to. And I think back on my sheet there, this document in 1965, at the 25th anniversary approximately, this dialogue document Dialogue and Proclamation, which is about 40, 50 pages long, a much more full document you can also get from the internet site, or I can lend you a copy, beginning to ask, if this is true and if we begin to have a more open attitude toward other religious traditions, what are we supposed to do then? And after the council, between 65 and 91, setting up offices in the Vatican itself and then in the different local churches around the world, offices aimed at interreligious dialogue, often aimed also at ecumenical relationships with Protestants and Orthodox, but seeking out in local areas of the world, Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists and Jews in particular, to have better contact with, to have regular kind of conversations and dialogue and so on. And in some ways, I think the church throughout this entire period was really discovering, and this perhaps is the key point here because I want to go fairly quickly, is that the future of the church continues, and the Vatican Council never backed down, and none of the documents since the Vatican Council have never backed down on the idea of evangelization or preaching the gospel. But it's almost impossible nowadays to find any church document in the Roman Catholic Church in which evangelization or preaching is not also connected with interreligious dialogue. Again, how it's done, what is actually known, whether it's done properly, whether the pieces fit together, all of that is complicated. But you see very much in Dialogue and Proclamation, I mentioned there also a bit further down, Dominus Iesus, the church document in 2000, kind of pulling back and saying, wait a minute, we're not talking about relativism, or we're not saying that other churches are as good as our church, or that you can learn from Hinduism the way you can learn from Christianity. Backing away from it, but nonetheless, even Dominus Iesus, in its great caution and great kind of concern about watering down values, a document that's also been greatly criticized, nonetheless saying, we admit that dialogue and evangelization go together. And people often don't believe it, but the Pope has said, this current Pope, who's been more than almost 25 years now, is that dialogue should not be sacrificed for the sake of preaching, and preaching should not be sacrificed for the sake of dialogue. So it's kind of like a mantra. I mean, it's nice to say, how do you actually do it? But the fact that it's being said, I think, has changed the conversation. And my perception is that most of the theological writing in the Catholic Church and most of the official documents that come out of Rome are no longer simply about how to preach the gospel or how to pass judgment on other traditions, but on how can you engage in dialogue as fully as possible and not kind of betray your starting point as a Christian. And the dialogue is now not going to go away. It's part of the Catholic Church. I think the word dialogue is not actually used in Vatican II in the Nostra Aetate document, but sort of became the kind of new theological term for after the council. And I think, therefore, a lot of the energy today in terms of Christian doctrine, in the Catholic Church at least, will be Christian truth, Christian identity, witness to Christ, and interreligious dialogue. And an awareness, and this is what follows in the 2, 3, and 4 I have here, how do you do dialogue properly really becomes the issue. It's not really an issue for Roman Catholics today, at least those who follow the Vatican, to think, you know, maybe we could drop dialogue. But dialogue is part of the church. How do we do it properly is the question that is remaining. Number 2 there goes in one way, and number 3 goes another. Under 2, what I have in mind, looking at books like the ones I've been pointing out to you, this book by Jacques Dupuy, Christianity and the Religions, is really the third of a series of books he's done on the topic, and you may want to take a look. And then Michael Barnes, a Jesuit teaching at Heathrop College in London, on really the encounter with the other, my number 3 there. symptomatic or emblematic books, again, surprisingly by Jesuits, but that's just sort of by chance, I suppose, books that I think represent where things are. And what I have in mind under number two with Jacques Dupuy, and it's certainly not Dupuy only, is that to have a church that is really committed to interreligious dialogue, we have to understand differently the doctrines of the Catholic Church. So it can't be simply, all right, we basically keep our sense of Christology, creation, the Trinity, the teachings of the Church entirely as they used to be, and we just sort of tack interreligious dialogue onto the side of it. But rather, we have to ask ourselves, what is God like and what is Christ like, and how does God work in the world, such that interreligious dialogue is something Catholics should be doing. And it's sort of from this challenge of dialogue, which sort of, again, popped up and became a prominent element, saying we have to rethink what we think about Christ and about the Trinity itself. And very briefly, because this, again, could be a whole course that I'm probably not competent to give, it seemed to me that on the one hand, there's an exploration of the meaning of Christ, Jesus Christ, and a sense that Jesus Christ, who is the Son of God come into the world, is definitely Jesus of Nazareth, the historical person Jesus who lived in Nazareth and who died on the cross. But people like Dupuy are also saying, well, Jesus is also the Christ, is also the Son of God. And the total focus on Jesus of Nazareth must still leave room for the fact that the Son of God works more widely in the world. And there's a way, it sounds paradoxical, but to say that Jesus Christ works outside of Jesus Christ, that the Son is at work more widely in the world. Jesus in John's Gospel is called the Word of God. Well, the Word of God is spoken more widely in the world, and that somehow is the Son of God, but it's not identically the same as Jesus of Nazareth. Now, a lot of the theological tension is you don't want to have Jesus over here and the Son of God over there, or the Word and Jesus in separate places. But a sense of people like Dupuy saying, we have to say Jesus is the Son of God, but not that everything that God does in the world through the Son is done in an identifiably Christian way in the person of Jesus. It's a tricky thing to say, but I think part of the point and part of the struggle that professional Christology professors worry about more than me is how to say properly that the mystery of the second person of the Trinity is greater than what we know about the historical Jesus, and there's a way in which our understanding of the second person has to be larger. Likewise, the Trinity. There's a great push in Dupuy and similar theologians on the importance of rediscovering a theology of the Holy Spirit. Because the tendency in the church had been say, you know, Jesus alone saves. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. No salvation except by the death of Christ. Well, what about the fact that we actually believe in a Trinitarian God in the Christian church, Father, Son, and Spirit? Is the Spirit of God entirely predictable and limited to working in explicitly Christian context? No. Can we imagine ways in which the Spirit of God is working in the world that are not entirely limited to the work of Jesus Christ? Again, you don't want to separate them and say, well, there's Jesus doing things over here and the Spirit's over there and they meet occasionally to talk about it. Not that kind of thing, because that would be very confusing. But that somehow we have to talk about the mystery of God's Spirit working in the world, which is truly God in the world. It's not like, you know, a second-rate God. Jesus is the first-rate God and the Spirit is second-rate. But truly God's Spirit is working in the world. Those alleged rays of light in other religions are actually truly God present. It's the Spirit of God. And that somehow this is not the same as the work of the Son, not the same as the work of Jesus. It's not separate either, because Father, Son, and Spirit are one God. But that somehow you have to have a much broader notion, bringing back to life the Spirit as well as the Son. I would add, too, in a way that I think Dupuy does, but he doesn't stress it as much, the traditional Catholic teaching on the work of God as creator, the Father, and the idea that the world itself is created by God, and therefore God is everywhere, always present in the world already. Whatever is somehow the product of God. So this is an example simply of turning back within and saying if we take dialogue seriously, the Catholic Church has had to say we have to change ourselves. The problem that we run into with books like Dupuy's books, even though he spent 40 years or so in India, it tends to be very abstract about the other religions. And it's still a very strong sense that we can rethink Christian doctrine, we can think Christology, we can think the Trinity by talking to other Christian theologians and reading the Christian tradition. Dupuy has kind of the base for going out, but he doesn't actually do very much of it. Quite different is Michael Barnes' book, Theology and the Dialogue of Religions, in which Barnes really takes up the issue of, if we're talking about dialogue as opposed to monologue, and if we're talking about a real interactive relationship with the other, then a real task for any church that says we're interested in dialogue, or anybody interested in dialogue, is not reducing the other to kind of a shallow image of yourself. You have to allow the other to be different from yourself. And there's a tendency in, I think in human reality probably, but there's also a tendency in theological circles of saying, I'm very willing to talk to you, but I already know everything you're going to say. And there's nothing you can say that will really change me, because I realize what you end up having to say is basically you have to agree with me eventually. Somewhat like de Nobili, I thought eventually that the Brahmins, if they really thought about what they believed, they would actually say, I agree with you entirely. Barnes is saying, no, if you have a dialogue with an other whom you truly admit to be other, then you don't control the dialogue. The other can say things that you do not expect. The other can have aspects of herself or himself that you have not fully probed. The other can act in ways and use language that is not your language and not your ways of speaking. And so on down the road, that there's a whole kind of new world, and he uses contemporary postmodern thinkers like Desserteau, Levinas, who very much reflecting on the experience of the Holocaust and Jewish identity after the Holocaust. Barnes very much kind of struggling to say, if we've committed ourselves to dialogue, we may not actually have realized what we're getting into. And this requires of us a much greater openness to the mystery of the other. That's quote number 8 on the other side is from Barnes' book. And this, I think, captures the spirit of him. The church speaks of what it knows in faith, that God has raised Jesus from the dead and thereby transformed the whole of creation. What the church does not know is the total reality of what is always remains others and utterly mysterious. Christians must therefore acknowledge this possibility, that God may act in the world in ways of which the church does not know. Now, the church is always recognized as a mystery, and God's mystery is very great. But I think Barnes is pushing it further by saying, well, this actually means the church doesn't know things, and that we can't go into dialogue saying, well, I actually know everything already. Anything less than this, a willingness to admit we don't know, would risk putting an arbitrary limit on the action of God. The Christian experience of the grace of God acting freely and generously to create a people for himself, demands an openness to the spirit at work in the world of the other, without reducing the other to an example of myself. I think people like de Nobili, historically, probably maybe implicitly in their experience, discovered the other and were changed, but their language was really that insofar as the other is other, they're wrong. Insofar as they're not other, they're right. And there was a way in which the tradition had a hard time getting a hold of true others, and that I think Barnes is challenging us to today. Barnes also, I mean, Barnes is actually, he actually engages in interreligious dialogue. He lives in the Southall section of London and is constantly involved in dialogue with all the very varied local community. But his writing is basically, again, reflection on the European and Christian tradition. My final point, because I want to give Martin a chance to say, who's been giving lectures on the same subject, more or less. Number 4 is really what I'm doing in these lectures, and more so starting next week, is if you do have this sense of dialogue is intrinsic to how we think about being Catholic today, if dialogue is changing the way we think about Christian doctrines, if we have to believe that we don't already know the other entirely, then we actually have to engage in crossing the boundaries in order to be Christian theologians today. If we're going to understand our own church, our own tradition, our own Christology, our own Trinitarian theology, we can't do it by simply saying, I have respect for the other and now I'll think about myself again. But there has to be this kind of travel through the other and back with many different traditions. But the example that I'll be using is that of the Hindu traditions, certain Hindu traditions, which I'll talk more about next week. But that to be a Christian in the 21st century, be a Roman Catholic Christian in the 21st century who is thinking with the church and following the example of the Pope, one has to enter into a dialogue with the other religions which is not reducible to a few generalities or kind of speculation about salvation, but kind of learning the other without reducing the other to oneself. The last thing I'll say, and then Martin will speak briefly, and then we'll open it up for a few minutes. The reason I set up this page, it took me all of a half hour to figure out how to do it properly, was to kind of wrap around this page, the other side, which you have to meditate on in the week to come, some of the quotations I've been talking about from the Syllabus of Errors, from Vatican II, from Dialogue and Proclamation, Dominus Iesus, Dupuy, Barnes, the lovely quote from myself there, number 7. All of these things arranged around a quote from one of the texts I'm working on in the book I'm working on now, the Gunaratna Kosha, a text honoring the goddess Lakshmi of the south of the Sanskrit tradition, primarily South Indian tradition. In this text, the eternal consort of the god Vishnu, and this text, which is from approximately the 12th century or so, the author Parashara Bhattar is praising the goddess Lakshmi, praising her in two ways. In the first of the verses, verse 14, about how she is known in scripture, in the Upanishads, in the Ramayana, in the Puranas or mythic narratives, as I translate it, in the epics like the Mahabharata, not simply there is a goddess or is there is the mystery, but a particular goddess, Lakshmi, who's known in our tradition. And then the second verse, this kind of relationship, kind of erotic and beautiful and very subtle between the god and the goddess, and how they kind of live in perpetual enjoyment of one another as the eternal divine couple. The reason I put this quote in the middle, and there could be lots of other quotes, is it raises the stakes greatly. It's nice to say God is at work in other religions. What do you do when you run into kind of a sophisticated, multi-level tradition which has a sense of what it believes, it has a sense of its authority structure, its tradition of scriptures, it has a very sophisticated theory of the male and the female and the divine. What do you do with that? Do you sort of say, well, that's very nice, now let's move on? Or how would you allow that to kind of get involved in thinking about the Christian God or the meaning of Christian faith? It creates a big problem that I think none of us around the circle around it really deal with completely. But it's the kind of thing I want to be talking about next week. But before I mess this up entirely, I'd like to give Martin a few minutes, and then maybe we'll have a few minutes for questions. Again, Martin, those of you who are new here, Martin Guarneri at Blackfriars will be giving week 6 lecture, and so this is a preview of things to come.
Well, I just want to highlight two areas of tension, really, which I think can be underplayed, or certainly very prominent. And the first thing is in the relationship between evangelization and dialogue, because as you rightly point out, that the official teaching of the church is one in which dialogue, you know, goes along with evangelization, is a function of evangelization. But it's easy to underestimate the tension that's still felt in the Catholic Church between evangelization and dialogue. And obviously theology, you know, is being done for the life of the church, primarily Catholic theology. I've experienced this in being involved in more practical promotion of dialogue within this country. And it strikes me that, I mean, one has to be sensitive to the reasons why there's a tension, which is going to be different in different countries and different contexts. I mean, I think it's fair enough to say in this country, where the Catholic Church is in a state of crisis in different ways, there's certainly a sense of being under threat, of contracting, of being in a secular and increasingly hostile society, that it feels, you know, under imperiled, so it feels it doesn't really have time to be active towards dialogue because it feels you've kind of just got to hang on. So that's one particular context where there's a particular type of tension between evangelization and dialogue. And obviously it could be different in different places. In India it would be different because there are different pressures involved there. The Christian community is in a different situation. The first thing I want to say then is that, I mean, I think there's an ongoing tension still, very strong tension between evangelization and dialogue, which can't be just resolved in any one particular context. It has to be sensitive to the context in which it's taking place. And the other thing is really another tension, possibly a more creative one, you know, which is to do with, you know, developing Christian theology of religions in the light of Hinduism, in thinking of the title of the lecture. And partly we've touched upon it already, I mean, thinking about Nostra Aetate and its kind of description of Hinduism. But if you're involved in wanting to think carefully about the relationship to the Hindu tradition and the Catholic tradition, in the light of studying the Hindu traditions, then obviously you're going to be, you know, in different ways dissatisfied with Nostra Aetate, and it becomes especially urgent when you're dealing with trying to ensure that Catholics themselves are informed about how to do the dialogue properly, about how to understand Hinduism properly, because you become very conscious of the fact that most Catholic readers magisterial documents will just stay with them, that they themselves won't enter into a kind of critical analysis of the text. So I think there's a challenge, a creative challenge, as time goes on, to be critical of the kind of descriptions you get in text. But I suppose even more interesting is just thinking about De Puy's work. I mean, his question he finishes off with, the kind of theme of the book, is whether we can actually say that the tradition, the other religious traditions themselves, other than the Christian one, Catholic one, actually have a positive role to play in divine saving plans. And that's where the kind of hard question is, really. And well, how is that affected by developing a dialogue of a theology of religions in the light of the study of other religions? And I would certainly tend to think that the tendency that sympathetic study of another religion has, and certainly I would feel in the case of or sympathetic study of Hinduism, is that you tend very much to want to answer in a positive way those kind of questions. It becomes very difficult, I think, when you get into studying a sophisticated tradition, not to want to say that this is in some way inspired, this has a positive value, rather than just being kind of natural product of human reasoning, or kind of just having odd bits. But you want to say, I think the dynamic of study is you actually want to say quite strong things, and so you end up, I think, in again a kind of tension, because say Dominus Iesus, I mean, not to be too critical of it, but I mean, it's certainly drawing back from being very positive about other traditions. So I think kind of doing things in the kind of not just in the a priori way does actually have quite a strong effect.
Thank you. I would just add that the kinds of questions you're raising, I think the question sometimes can make it extremely daunting for theologians who are not specialists. I mean, people like me, I can do my Sanskrit and so on, and then everybody thinks I know what I'm talking about. But theologians often are in the position of saying, well, how can I possibly do this well? And how can I, the paradox of dialogue and evangelization, or how can I possibly come up with some intelligent way of talking about Hinduism? Often can be paralyzing and say, well, I can't, so I won't. I'll do something else. And I think part of the challenge of the questions that I was raising, and then Martin raising very, I think, complimentary questions, is trying to demonstrate in lectures like this, how can you do it well if you're not the specialist, and how does what the specialist does contribute back to the larger conversation inside one's own religious tradition? We have a few minutes left. This another religion lecture at 3:30, which I realize not many of you have been going to, but we have a few minutes before we stop. If anyone has to leave immediately, please do. But any comments or questions? Or yes, Professor.
Well, as you emphasized, perhaps the dialogue with the other religious groups really helps one to understand one's own religion much better. As we see in the instance of Sri Shankaracharya, well, he had a lot of dialogues with the Mimamsakas and the Buddhists. And he fashioned his own Advaita, taking many points from Buddhism. He ran the risk of being called as Prachanda Bautha, a disguised Buddhist, but then he didn't mind it. And Buddhism and Advaita have really, they are responsible for, say, turning the emphasis of Hinduism on Ahimsa. And that has really, you know, reformed Hinduism to a greater extent. And as you say, this dialogue with other religious groups really has been helpful, as the history has pointed out.
Thank you. It's excellent to give examples from outside the Christian tradition. They weren't always positive dialogues. I mean, sometimes there was a lot of polemic attitudes back and forth or criticism, but I think you're right. It changed the nature of Vedanta learning from the Buddhists and other traditions.
And all this, they derived the source from the Rigveda itself, which says, Ano Bhadraha Kratroyantu Vishvataha. Let noble thoughts come to us from all directions.
I guess a comment also for your response. It doesn't seem like, it does seem in order to have fruitful dialogue, like take that word seriously, that Christian doctrine has got to be very much reformulated, their whole conception of what is salvation, who is God, and so on and so forth. Because the way it's structured, it's not a dialogue. It doesn't allow for dialogues, really, with other religions, especially distant religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, and so forth. Just sort of like realizing that and just going forward.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the tricky thing, because in some ways you can say, well, the internal logic of my tradition based on our faith and our reading of our sources and so on is something we need to do. And yet I think when you commit yourself to dialogue, as Dupuy was doing, say, well, what must our God must be like? What must our God be like such that dialogue is now an imperative?
Mm-hmm.
Rethink, already beginning to rethink the Christian doctrines in light of the other. And then Barnes and me and others pushing it further by saying, well then, all right, that's nice in general, but then you actually have to engage the other and then not be afraid to rethink the things you started with. And that's very touchy. If you talk about personal experience, it's not so bad. But if you talk about saying in different ways traditional doctrines of the church because we have talked to Jews and Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus and so on, is a radical transformation that takes place. And it's very difficult to do, because it's not only, you know, I do it and then I write a book and I say everything is different now, but how to get us to do it, or how to have a sense of we, the church, change is a very challenging process. But that's where it leads, because if we have dialogue, and we'll have dialogue provided in the end nothing ever changes, that will eventually wear out. You know?
Mm-hmm.
One of the early part, you said that one of the author's books suggested that we all need religion, or we all open to religion.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, listening to various talks both on religion and the science, neuroscientist view about religion, that in a way the human evolution has been such that it is the religion, the adaptation of the human gene requiring the brain to want to understand the world, asking questions like, how did I come about to be here? Why am I here, and what's going to happen to me later on, has been one of the things that has allowed culture to develop and let the humans develop to what they are. And how does the church and how does the religious people feel about being the scientists who are coming up with the theory that we have evolved evolutionary adaptation to have the religious thing, and this can be proven by the fact that certain people with certain problems in a particular part of the brain have enhanced religious experience when they've never had any before at all, or had any concept of religion. In other words, the concept of religion is in fact an evolutionary phenomenon
that then is superseded and passed by.
And my point. point is that if it is an evolutionary phenomenon, that is the most fundamental commonality between all religion.
Yeah.
Because the evolution starts asking this question in itself.
I mean, I think I may have been referring to Karl Rahner, but also Vatican II at that point about the profoundly religious nature of the human. Often, like Rahner, was developed from a metaphysical position, sort of in Greek philosophy or German metaphysics, toward the sense of the human and the finite and so on.
Yeah.
I think you're pointing to the fact that there'd be a complementarity with discoveries in science. Now, the fear, of course, in most religious people would be a kind of reductionism, that it's not actually true religion, it's actually just something in the brain, and a fear about that. But I think, aside from that issue, which is a separate issue maybe, the idea that there's a biological, psychological, social, cultural commonality that we have could be another much tighter point of connection.
Yes, the connection is, in other words, saying that we all believe, we all require a religion, whether it's in the form of a psychological schema or whatever it may be, to answer these three questions.
Yeah. Okay.
And each religion attempts in its own way to answer those three questions.
Yeah, I think that would be, I mean, part of the, if it's part of nature, it's part of how we're built. I mean, from a most religious perspective, well, God made us that way, so we should do something with that factor.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes?
If all human beings are fundamentally religious, what does one mean by that? And if one means the same for each religion, how much mileage is there, do you think, in trying to work out the philosophical basis that is different, that the Christian idea of heaven in fact exists in other religions, but with a completely different set of symbols, a different set of philosophy, and Christian idea of personality is a limiting factor. And if that, if you were to go along that road, that is the philosophical, Western philosophical understanding of things that separates us, where would you start? With what particular doctrines would you personally start?
In terms of exploring this common ground? Well, first of all, on the question of what does it mean that people are essentially religious, I think, as I said to you, I mean, people like Rahner have a history in German metaphysics and probably back to Aquinas and then to Aristotle on openness to the infinite and the nature of transcendence or the nature of human knowing is opening to the mystery and so on. One could argue in those terms, I mean, anthropologists tend to argue in terms of descriptive practices, in terms of how people enact their lives through use of symbolism, through ritual practices and so on. Some of that has ended up being described as religious. But the problem is then, that if I understand you, you're pointing to then, is if you try to go beyond some of the generalities and you notice that there are common features, what does one learn from the significant differences among the traditions? And what I tried to illustrate by setting up these lectures this way is what now will be next week, take the category of revelation, and what is said in the Hindu traditions about that, and what can that possibly mean for somebody committed to Christian revelation? Arguments for the true religion, how have Hindus argued for the true religion against false religions? Martin will be taking up the topic of creation. Then I'll take up again the topic of divine embodiment, and then if we keep coming back, I could also do salvation, which was scheduled for 8th week. I'm starting with those are sort of large categories that I could imagine say something about, but one could do it more specifically with attitudes toward death, the notion of the afterlife. We're having the Hindu Center sponsoring 2 seminars tomorrow at 5 and next week at 5 on food and dining customs in Judaism and Hinduism. One could talk about the meal or the symbolism of community sharing in traditions. And I think it's going to come down to, Marcus sort of alluded to this in a way, I mean, or you find some things in common right away, and then you see lots of differences, and then you end up making judgments about, well, how much should I count the similarities and how much should I count the differences? But I do think, and this goes back to what I was saying to Jonathan, if you take, as I'll try to show you next week, if you take a category like Revelation and start trying to ask what could possibly be Revelation, or the word Revelation, or the concept in the Hindu traditions, figuring it out and realizing it's not quite the same, there are analogies and differences, then what could possibly be learned from a Christian other than saying it's somewhat the same and somewhat different? And I think the challenge is to say there has to be some fruitful theological progress by going and coming back. Did that answer you, or did I avoid your question?
No, it gives topics.
Which are just the starting point, and we'll have to see how it goes. Thank you. We probably should stop there. And
What happened to week 8?
Well, it's a question. I would say week 8 will be salvation if people are not too tired by Trinity term and say, let's stop with week 7. Or there is no salvation and says nothing. Thank you all. If anyone didn't get the handout, I realize I may not have brought enough. Did anyone not get today's handout?
I expect to do it this year.
Bring them back next week or fill them out now.